Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday. I have to give you the background because every now and then things happen in life and you have to think, oh my, this is amazing. This happened and it must have been just serendipitous or even planned for years and years and years and years. I decided earlier, you get on those ideas. Well, I'm going to learn about somebody. I'm going to do maybe six people during the course of a year who I think were geniuses, and I'm going to learn everything I can before I have to go on to the next book. So the person I thought of was Michelangelo, because I love Michelangelo. And so I decided to read The Agony and the Ecstasy again, and then got an art book, and then was listening to a series of lectures on Michelangelo. And I was telling KP about it and said, why don't we do a show, he said, on Michelangelo? Well, can we get away with doing that? I don't think we can. And then a new book, a great book about Michelangelo, arrives in the mail, and by golly, we got ourselves a show. So thank you, Miles Unger, our guest this hour, for writing this book so we can talk about Michelangelo. And actually, I'm sure we're going to get a lot of response to this program because his book is about a life in six masterpieces. So he writes extensively about the Pietà, the David, the Sistine Ceiling, the Medici Tombs, the Last Judgment, and the Basilica of St. Peter's. And Miles is the author of three books on Renaissance Italy. So many of you know a lot, I'm sure, about Michelangelo. You've seen his works, and he is worth talking about. And then we can figure out who the next genius might be we'll want to talk about. And then another book will miraculously appear, and we'll talk about another genius. Miles is author of Machiavelli, a biography, Magnifico, The Brilliant Life and Violent Times of Lorenzo de Medici. He has covered cultural issues for The Economist and for The New York Times and has written for many publications. And he has lived in Florence for 5 years and continues to travel to that country. So we're delighted to have Miles with us this hour, and we'll be welcoming phone calls. We always do that. The number is 800-486-8655. We could ask you, of all the Michelangelo you've seen, which do you think is the most moving, the most important to you? Call us with your thoughts or put them on our Facebook page. Miles, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you for that lovely intro.
Yeah, I'm so glad you wrote the book. It was just, I can't tell you. I wonder if that's happened to somebody else. It was such perfect timing in my life. It was astounding.
Well, I'm glad. These books take years to come to fruition, so I don't know if it was the stars, good karma, or just good luck. But yeah. Anyway, I'm happy it came at the right time in your life.
Yeah, it definitely was good luck, no doubt about it. Tell me about your years in Florence. I envy you that you had a chance to see Michelangelo every day if you wanted to. You probably did.
I did, whether the real ones or the reproductions they have scattered about the city. I spent the major portion of the time I was in Florence, I was a young, impressionable kid, and for somebody who liked art as I did, and history, it was just, I went there when I was 11, and stayed till I was 16, and it was a magical period, and it took me a long time to sort of get back to this period. I had written about art I became a not very good artist for a while, and then I started writing about art. And so, finding my way back to this period, which was really my first love, it was a wonderful opportunity for me. And I took it and I ran with it. Mm. You mentioned it's my third book on the Italian Renaissance.
Mm-hmm. And of all the artists, and you're writing about a time where there were many, many greats, it's been said that Michelangelo stands above them. Would you put him way above everybody else or not?
Well, that's a little hard to say. I mean, I wouldn't say his friend, but his acquaintance and rival, Leonardo da Vinci, was no slouch.
You're right.
And then there was Raphael, another one of his rivals. It's interesting how Michelangelo always treated any artist with talent as a rival rather than a colleague. Very sort of jealous and competitive. Leonardo was a generation older than he was, and Michelangelo always felt that the older man patronized him. And then with Raphael, he thought he was a young whippersnapper who was trying to steal all his ideas. So I don't know if I Michelangelo certainly accomplished more in more areas than even Leonardo. At least artistically, Leonardo obviously had the sort of a wonderful scientist and had all those wonderful inventions. But in terms of his artistic production, as you know, both a painter, a sculptor, an architect, and even a poet, I think he stands alone.
Yeah, and there are certain things that I've had the great fortune years and years ago of seeing some of his works in Florence. But I got to tell you, when I walked into that Sistine Chapel, it just almost made me fall down. There was something that was just unbelievable about seeing it, and you just know that you're almost in the presence of a saint of some kind, that there was more than being an artist involved here, and I know others have said the same about him, right?
Right. Well, he was referred to often as Michelangelo, and punning on his name, they would call him Angel Divine. And that was already current in his own lifetime, and he was not above sort of cultivating his own
image. Right.
But he was seen as extraordinary even in his own lifetime. He was not one of these artists who, you know, died in a garret, you know, obscure somewhere. He was world famous. He was incredibly wealthy, but he was still unhappy. It being in his nature to be unhappy, but I think he was. Certainly recognized in his own time as extraordinary. And I think that he sort of set the stage for the notion of the artist as a distinctive personality. I think because his own personality was so strong,
yes,
and because it is so strongly expressed in his work. I mean, if you compare it to, let's say, Raphael, who was his slightly younger contemporary, who's an artist of incredible gift and skill, one doesn't really have the sense of Raphael coming through.
Mm-hmm.
Leonardo's a little different. Leonardo's personality one can sense it a bit in that kind of enigmatic kind of mystery that he tends to give his paintings. But he tends to be also something of a cipher. Whereas if you see Michelangelo and you see enough of his work, you really get a sense that you're in the presence of the artist and the force of his personality coming through.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is one of the things. He sort of sets the model for the notion that an artist is primarily engaged in a form of self-expression, that his own distinctive personality has to come through in the work. And this is, I called him at, I think, one point, the world's first modern artist. And this is what I mean by that. I mean, in many ways, he was very different from our contemporary notion of an artist, but in the sense that art was about self-expression. You know, you sort of had to let, you know, your own idiosyncratic personality, your own distinctive a vision come through. That's very much the sort of the model that Michelangelo set, and you know, it was repeated in some of the great geniuses who followed.
And also his really thoughtful examination and subsequent powerful demonstration of how he wanted to represent Jesus, Mary, and Pietà, which was very different. There was a long thought process about his interpretation, and that's fascinating as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that the Pietà, which was a work that he did as a young man, a very young man of 22, 23, so it's his first sort of major work, the one that made him famous, but he is very conscious of sort of stamping his own signature on it. It's,
right.
It's the only work he ever signed, and as if he was sort of declaring ownership of it in a way that was considered actually quite shocking to his contemporaries.
I think it's still shocking, really.
Yeah. Particularly, he puts in a very sort of intimate place across Mary's breasts, you know, the strap that runs across her blouse, and putting your signature in such a prominent place in a sacred image was considered arrogant, hubristic, and in fact, his biographer Vasari found it so shocking that he had to make up an obviously false story in order to explain it. He claims that Michelangelo, after the work was installed, overheard some people from Milan saying, "Oh, yes, this work was done by Arrigo from Milan," and Michelangelo saying he didn't want other people to get credit for it. Sneaks into the basilica at night and then carves his name on the.
Oh my!
So that was a way of justifying this, what otherwise would have been seen as a kind of arrogant act. But in fact, I think what Michelangelo is doing is he's claiming authorship of a sacred work in a way that was unusual for that day and age, when sacred works were almost supposed to be, something that came from, God above or heaven above. And in fact, there are many stories in the Renaissance and in the Middle Ages of artists who, try to paint the Virgin or Jesus or some other sacred scene, throw down their brushes in disgust, fall asleep, and then the image is completed by an angel. This is a very old story, but that was sort of the way that art was thought of before Michelangelo, as something almost not created by an individual, but by, divine inspiration. But Michelangelo, by signing this work and making it so idiosyncratic and making it so much his own, is really declaring authorship in a way that was sort of set the stage for artists and artistic egos to come.
And tell me how word spread of the Pietà. It made him well known. How so? Did some people come to Rome and they saw it, or what happened?
Well this is the sort of the beginning of art becoming discussed publicly by literary figures. Mm. Art had gained enough prestige by this point, and the most famous artists were talked about enough, so that there was a from the courts of Ferrara and Venice and France, people would, the rich and powerful who collected art were interested in sort of, discovering the next new artist who might be commissioned to do a work to memorialize them. So Rome was certainly the center of this. One of the reasons Michelangelo goes from Florence to Rome is because he knows that this is the stage, where he can make a name for himself. And he sculpts this work for a very prominent French cardinal, Cardinal de Saint-Denis. And there were, Rome was a place where pilgrims came, great lords and ladies of Europe came. The cardinals came from all over Europe. So if you did a successful piece and it put it in St. Peter's did it for a prominent cardinal, word would get around. And that's certainly why Michelangelo goes there and does this commission, is he really is, it was difficult to make a name for himself in Florence at that time. But Rome was a place where he knew if he sort of made it on that stage, right, he would become world famous.
Yeah. You write, and you've also written a book about Lorenzo, so you'll have a lot of background for us here. But every now and then you meet somebody in your life, and it's very fortuitous because they play a huge role in your life. You write in the early parts of your book on Michelangelo, it's difficult to overstate the significance of the 2 years that Michelangelo spent under Lorenzo de' Medici's roof. He was the father he wished he never had, he wished he had and felt that he deserved, and also was incredibly influential in allowing Michelangelo to expand his knowledge, to talk with artists, to talk with poets, and to really forge ahead as a significant artist. It's good they met, huh?
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, one of the things about Florence at the end of the 15th century, it was hard to walk down the street without bumping into another genius. So Michelangelo was not the only one.
Right.
There were a couple of literary geniuses already at Lorenzo de' Medici's palace, the great philosopher Pico della Mirandola and Marsilio Ficino, and the great poet Angelo Poliziano. So Lorenzo had brought together this wonderful literary and artistic court, and then he discovers Michelangelo sculpting away in his sculpture garden and immediately takes the talented young man under his wing. And I think this is very important for Michelangelo because his own father was a kind of doer and grumpy man who when Michelangelo told him he wanted to be an artist, sort of beat the tar out of him. He thought this was no fit, profession for his son. But when he went to, when he goes to the great lord of Florence's house and is taken under his wing and is exposed to all this poetry and scholarship, he really sees for the first time, or has confirmation of what he himself believed, which was that art could be a noble profession, and it was an intellectual profession. It was art in the way that we think of it, but not so much the way that it was thought of it in his own time, as a higher calling, not merely a craft, but that you could practice the sort of most profound and express the most profound emotions and thoughts to which a human being is capable of in the medium of painting or sculpture.
Let's talk a little bit more about his father and his family, because it really is interesting that his father thought it was terrible that he was going to become an artist. But as you point out, he subsequently becomes the only one of his brothers to be able to make a living, and a really darn good living, from his work. And the rest of them don't. So he's kind of supporting the family, isn't he?
Right. Well, it's a funny irony that his, you know, proud father thinks, you know, the role of artist is beneath his son. But, of course, you know, he's too proud to actually earn a living.
Right.
He told Lorenzo de' Medici in one famous meeting that, you know, well, I've practiced no profession in my life, as if this is a great boast.
Right. Yeah.
He considers himself an aristocrat. The Buonarroti felt they were descended from the greatest family of Tuscany, the Counts of Canossa, and so, you know, they were proud, but they had no money, which was a bad combination. He was a very, you know, his father Ludovico had very traditional views on, you know, what was a suitable career for a gentleman, and that was one where you didn't get your hands dirty. You know, sculpture in particular was seen as a kind of grimy profession where you got your hair full of dust and you were working with your hands, and your hands were calloused. And to Michelangelo's father, you know, this is no way for a gentleman to spend his time. It was Michelangelo who becomes famous. I don't think anybody would remember the Buonarroti if it weren't for Michelangelo. And he also became extremely wealthy, allowing his father and his ne'er-do-well brothers to live in the splendor to which they felt they were entitled.
Mm. And you also write that Michelangelo's conception of himself as a superior being was not based on his immense talent, maybe not even principally. It sprang initially from his pride, so it kind of ran through his blood, too, and belonging to this very noble lineage.
Right. I mean, I think Michelangelo was nothing if not conflicted. And, you know, he, like many greatly talented men and women, he had this compulsion to be an artist, but he had already internalized the prejudices of his class against this kind of work, which was still largely seen as kind of manual labor, even if sort of on a higher level than, you know, being a stonemason or something. But it was still, you know, you worked with your hands. In the Renaissance, that meant you were somewhere beneath somebody who worked only with his mind. I think what he tried to do is, because he was felt compelled to be an artist, this is where his great talent and his passion lay, but he felt he belonged to some kind of, you know, to put it bluntly, he was something of a snob. He felt he had to raise the status of an artist to a new level. He needed to sort of create an aristocracy of the mind. So he sort of propels himself through, you know, hard work and sheer talent into the sort of echelon of the greats, where he could sit down side by side and converse with popes and kings. But this was a sort of a novel conception, and it's largely through Michelangelo's need to sort of merge his own sense of pride with his craft.
We're going to welcome phone calls. If you're like me, you are going to just welcome with open arms this new book on Michelangelo, told through the life in 6 masterpieces. Miles Unger is our guest. He has just published this wonderful book. Miles lived in Florence when he was 11 years old for 5 years and goes back to Italy frequently, I understand. He writes, was a former contributing writer for the New York Times, managing editor of Art New England. He's the author of 3 other books, including Magnifico, The Brilliant Life and Violent Times of Lorenzo de' Medici, and also a Machiavelli biography. This one is on Michelangelo, and it tells the fascinating stories of the Pietà. We have five other stories to get to: the story of David, of creation, the Medici tombs, and also the Last Judgment. Many of you have seen those, or you've studied them in books, or you've studied the life of Michelangelo, too, the world's greatest artist. What do you think of these works, your interpretation of them, or questions you may have about them? Here's how you do it. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. We're also on Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, all these devices. And that's at K Dunn Show. So please join our conversation and talk with us about Michelangelo. I want to tell you that this fall we have an event coming up very soon. It's a celebration of 10,000 interviews. Actually, I've done more than that, but that's 10,000 here, 21 years at Wisconsin Public Radio. So I'll be there to talk about what I've learned. What have I learned in 10,000 interviews? How could I possibly? Well, I'll figure it out. I've learned a lot, and you've probably learned a lot if you've stayed with me some of those years. So we're going to have a chance to hear me talk about that, and also you'll meet other WPR personalities. We'll have dinner, we'll have drinks, we'll have chocolate cake. We'll have all of this on September 25th at the Elm Grove Women's Club. We're also going to have this silent auction with great local prizes and a Milwaukee-themed art project that you can take home with you. Last day to register is coming up sooner than you think, September 11th. So please sign up now at WPR.org/Milwaukee. That's WPR.org/Milwaukee. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Miles Unger is the author of Michelangelo, A Life in Six Masterpieces. It's been described as a superb biography, which indeed it is. We're talking about it this hour and taking phone calls. Gary in Watertown is our first caller for you, Miles. Hi, Gary. Gary, are you there?
Yes.
Yes, go right ahead.
Hello? I'm on?
You are, Gary.
Yes, I was in the Sistine Chapel on the Fall of Man. The upper part of the serpent is a image of a woman. I often wondered about that.
One of the difficulties in dealing with the art of this time, for the art of any time, there's a kind of persistent misogyny to it. It's sort of the idea of the temptress being female, of Eve being the cause of mankind's ruin. All these are sort of pervasive in not only sort of traditional Christian doctrine, but in the art of the Renaissance. Michelangelo himself had rather unenlightened views about women for the most part, and very few close relationships with women throughout his life. The one exception being the great poet and religious mystic of Vittoria Colonna, with whom he had a very warm and deep friendship during the time he was painting The Last Judgment, and who certainly influenced his religious ideas. But this sort of image of the temptress as woman is goes a long way back, unfortunately, in Christian and artistic images as well.
Mm-hmm. And the answer to the question why he never married?
Well, I think Michelangelo, if he were alive today, would be considered gay. Now, this is a complicated question. People always fight over this question, whether Michelangelo
is
gay. But because there really was no concept of being gay in 16th century Italy. They looked at these matters somewhat differently. General belief was that sexuality, they were very uncomfortable with sexuality. Sexuality was sinful. The only exception they made was for sexual relations between a husband and a wife, and even that was sort of necessary but not exactly celebrated. So if all sex was sort of regarded as sinful, particularly any sex outside of marriage, then they really didn't care whether you were attracted to men or slept with prostitutes. They sort of would put all of that into the same category of the general sinfulness of mankind. So it's probably not true that Michelangelo thought of himself as being distinctive because he was more attracted to young men than he was to women. He was very tormented about his sexuality. He thought he was a sinner. He never married, and he was not that comfortable with women. But he did not, sort of, the way they sort of saw the human psyche and human sexuality was quite different. So to say whether Michelangelo was actually a homosexual or not, I think it's a complicated question and sort of almost an anachronistic question.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think his feelings about women certainly played into the fact that he never married. He also said that his art was his wife, and he didn't really want the distractions and complications of having a family. And he, insofar as he sort of cared about his family, he cared about his brothers and his father and carrying on the Buonarroti name. But he did that largely through his nephew, who he was encouraged to marry so the Buonarroti name could survive into the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
But he himself was not willing to do it.
Well, let's go back to the Sistine Chapel, which we haven't talked about much at all. How does it happen? And I'm interested in, as you write about, his initial thoughts about having to do the Sistine Chapel. For heaven's sakes, Michelangelo is a sculptor, isn't he? He's not a painter.
Right. Well, he often claimed that during his life. He said, "I am, painting is not my art," he said more than once, which is ironic considering he painted one of perhaps the most famous painting of all time.
Right.
Not bad for somebody.
Not too bad, no.
Yeah. Well, he was sort of coerced into doing it. The truth is he had more training in fresco painting than he wanted to admit. He always denied that his first teacher was the fresco painter, Domenico Ghirlandaio.
Mm-hmm.
The documents prove that he actually studied for a couple of years in Ghirlandaio's studio, where he no doubt helped him paint the frescoes in the church of Santa Maria Novella. So he did have training. He obviously preferred sculpture. That's the way he identified himself. But the Pope, Pope Julius, who had called Michelangelo to Rome to carve his tomb, eventually tires of that idea and says, "Well, why don't you paint the Sistine Chapel instead?" Michelangelo flees from Rome to get away from this tyrannical Pope who wants him to do something he had no interest in. But eventually, partly because Julius threatened to invade Florence if they didn't give the artist back to them, he was forced reluctantly to go back to Rome to paint the chapel. One of the interesting things, and this often happened in Michelangelo's career, was that even though he was reluctant at first, once he got involved in the project, he made it a much more ambitious project than the Pope had initially requested. The Pope had initially requested that he paint the 12 apostles on the ceiling, and Michelangelo was looking up at this vast space, and he tells the Pope, "This will turn out to be a very poor thing." And so the Pope says, "Okay, we'll do what you want." And so what he does is he covers 5,000 square feet with the greatest painting of all time.
Right.
So it's one of these things where, he had to be dragged kicking and screaming, but he was a perfectionist and enormously ambitious. So once he was doing it, he did it right.
Yeah. And when you write that he developed his own unique language to confront life's most profound mysteries, what do you mean by that in terms of what we see in the Sistine Chapel?
Well, there's been an enormous amount written about what the Sistine Chapel actually means. There is no real template for this particular approach. I mean, obviously the scenes on the top represent the Book of Genesis, which was logical. The rest of the Sistine Chapel was dedicated to the life of Moses and the life of Christ, which in Christian theological terms mean the life under the law, which is the life of Moses, life under grace, which is the life of Jesus, which sort of left room conceptually only for life before the law. So that would be the creation story before Moses, before the Ten Commandments. So that was sort of a logical outcome of you know, the sort of the theological meaning of the chapel. But within that, Michelangelo really made up his own interpretation. I mean, and many scholars have tried to read into it all these arcane, mysterious meanings. He, you know, for instance, he reverses the two scenes of the flood so that the drunkenness of Noah comes out of order, and people speculated endlessly about what he possibly could have meant. But Michelangelo was sort of his own theologian. He had a kind of idiosyncratic approach to scripture, and fortunately, Pope Julius gave him the freedom to sort of execute it as he chose. I mean, a good example of how sort of iconoclastic he was is, if you know the ceiling well, you know all those sort of nude men who sort of cavort around the ceiling. Mm-hmm. Nobody's ever been able to really explain their theological or scriptural meaning. I mean, they don't come anywhere in the Bible. But to Michelangelo, these figures were crucial because they sort of respond to what's going on in the scenes above them. They sort of twist and turn and they struggle. They're almost as if, you know, they stand in for humankind wrestling with the immensity of creation, the profound but disturbing truths that they see above them. So Michelangelo sort of invents these while sticking to the story of Genesis, sort of takes it on a very different journey and puts his own distinctive stamp on it. And this is something that he does throughout his life. I think, you know, one of the things that happens if you commissioned a work from Michelangelo, you could expect something unusual, something right. Disturbing, provocative, and, mm-hmm. and you had to be willing, if you were a pope or a cardinal or a king, to put up with that. And I'm sure there were some patrons who said, well, I want something more traditional. I'm not going to hire Michelangelo to do this. But for those with the courage to do it, he would come up with something idiosyncratic and very, very original.
We're talking about Michelangelo this hour. Miles Unger is our guest, just released a new book, and a good one it is, Michelangelo, A Life in Six Masterpieces. Welcoming your phone calls. A couple lines are open if you've been trying to get through. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Donald in Naperville. Hi, Donald.
Actually, I'm in Conover, Wisconsin, vacationing, but I heard the comment of just one signatured item by Michelangelo, and back in about 1978, I was visiting Rome, and the Church of St. Peter in Chains. And a statue in there was, we were advised, was a statue of Moses carved by Michelangelo in more than double human size. And the guide said, there's a signature on here. Would you look for it? We all looked around and we couldn't find anything. And then he said, well, look in the bottom of the V-shaped beard. And what do you see? And there in the bottom of the beard was a facial image, which the guide said was in the nature of the signature that Michelangelo put on that famous work of art. So I just thought I'd mention that. It wasn't a regular signature, but it was, as the guide put it, in the nature of a signature.
Huh. What about that, Miles?
Well, yes, an interesting point, and I don't know that particular self-portrait, which is what it would be. And certainly, though Michelangelo did not actually sign any other works with his name, he often put his own image in his works. This is most famously and most memorably in the Last Judgment, where he paints a self-portrait as the skin of St. Bartholomew. St. Bartholomew was supposedly flayed alive, and you have his sort of sagging skin, his flesh, carried by the saint holding up the sort of the symbol of his martyrdom. And in those features, you can see a kind of grotesque self-portrait of Michelangelo. And so he often put his own features. Another time is in the late Florentine Pietà, where he portrays himself as the old Nicodemus who carries the body of Christ. And I contend as well that in the conversion of Saul, the painting that Saul is also a self-portrait of Michelangelo, in particular because the Paul, when he was on the road to Damascus, was a relatively young man, and Michelangelo chooses to portray him as an old man, the way he was at the time that he painted it. So Michelangelo sort of injected himself into his work in various ways without actually signing them. So that, again, that's as I said, I don't know that particular story. I'll have to look more closely at that, at the fork in Moses' beard, to see if I find the faith. But it wouldn't surprise me. In these, he was egotistical enough to often inject his own features into his work.
Thanks, Donald. Mark in Chicago. Hi. Are you there, Mark?
Yes.
Go right ahead.
I wanted to say, make a note that I am a big Michelangelo fan. I wanted to hear his thoughts on how, you know, the doing the David, and it came from a strange piece of stone, and he carved such a masterpiece out of it. And then his thoughts on maybe if he passed the torch to the version that Bernini did, maybe less than 100 years later, that was, you know, even a little bit further along, a little more in the round, so to speak.
Mm. Well, he didn't pass the torch in the sense that they ever knew each other, were alive at the same point. Bernini certainly looked very closely at Michelangelo, and many people say that some of Michelangelo's late work was really responsible for the kind of dynamic art that would become known as the Baroque. As far as carving the David out of a damaged piece of stone, it's interesting if you look at the David, which, you know, for most people is, you know, this consummate work of art, you know, a work of enormous skill, and it's hard to see the fact that he had to sort of work around a block of marble that had already been worked on by another sculptor and had been rejected by others as unusable. But Michelangelo looked at the block and, you know, found that he could just make a figure in there. And it's very hard to tell that he sort of had to work around the inexpert carving that had come before. But if you can sort of see it a bit from the side, if you look at, not a view you usually see the David from, but if you look at it from the side, it's that he's rather shallow front to back, and that was in part to sort of accommodate the figure of David in the block as it came to him.
He was worried, and legitimately so, that commission was going to be given to Leonardo?
Well, Michelangelo was known to get a bit paranoid, and whether or not Leonardo would have taken the commission is, it seems unlikely. Leonardo, who's, as we all know, most famous as a painter, actually did a monumental work in sculpture in Milan, an equestrian sculpture that was never ended up being cast. But he certainly was skilled in working in three dimensions. But that was a work that was modeled in clay and meant to be cast in bronze. Stone carving is quite another issue, and there's no record of Leonardo doing a work in carved marble, much less a work on this scale. So it's unlikely that Leonardo was a serious threat to him, but it was enough to sort of goad him to rush back to Florence and sort of claim the commission for himself.
And who was David to Michelangelo? What did he hope to create?
Well, David was a traditional symbol of the Florentine Republic. Now, one of the things that it's hard for modern people to grasp, even if they're tourists going to Florence, is that Florence was not simply a city, it was actually a nation state. It was its own sovereign state. It was a small state, and it constantly felt under threat from larger states from abroad, the other large states of Italy, like Milan and the Papal States and Naples. And at this particular time in 1504, when Michelangelo carves the David, they were under threat from the armies of Cesare Borgia, who was the son of the Pope. And so it was meant as a great patriotic symbol, you know, sort of the underdog republic fighting off its foes, you know, the virtuous warrior taking arms against the infidel. And this had been a traditional subject for generations of Florentine artists. Donatello made a famous version of it, so did Verrocchio. But none of them are on the scale of Michelangelo's. I think Michelangelo took this patriotic theme and he universalized it into this image of sort of man as the hero of his own narrative, man as the as somebody if he sets his mind to it, can achieve all things. I think this is sort of, you know, David still stands as a great image of sort of man in the fullness of his powers. I'm always sort of reminded of that. I think it's a slogan for some razor company or something. It says, man at his best. And that's, I think, really what David is. It's man at his best. And I think this is Michelangelo at his most optimistic, his view of sort of the human animal as being this triumphant creature filled with the spirit of the Lord who can achieve anything he wants.
Miles Unger, our guest, his book, Michelangelo, A Life in Six Masterpieces. We're welcoming phone calls. Mark, thanks for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. You can always find us on Facebook as well, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow, during this time period, from June through October, every year, American Players Theater, what a treasure this has been, and it's wonderful it has survived all these years, produces eight plays in rotation at their indoor and beautiful outdoor theater located on 100 acres of hilly woods and meadows near Spring Green, Wisconsin. We'll have two wonderful members of the theater joining us tomorrow to talk about the season's shows. So that'll be good. All right, back to phone calls for Miles. Barb in Door County. Hi.
Hi. I'm just wondering if there's ever been any speculation that Michelangelo was on autistic spectrum with Asperger's syndrome, because a lot of well-known people like Temple Grandin have a remarkable ability to see things in 3D. And I just feel that if he could carve things without even doing a model, and even his paintings are so, give such a feeling of the 3D of the people in the paintings.
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm always a little skeptical about medical diagnoses of people who've been dead for 500 years. That doesn't mean that there isn't some truth in it. I just don't know how you sort of go about determining that without a sort of clinical without clinical observation. I will say that my sense of him, I mean, he was certainly a very difficult man. He did not necessarily relate to people well, but he seemed to have more the kind of temperamental, egocentric, just proud, touchy, sensitive personality. And I'm not an expert on this field, so I don't know if that those are characteristics of people on that spectrum. I've never read this about Michelangelo in particular. And it's also true that I think that, you know, he was a product of one of the great schools of sculpture, great traditions of sculpture. And, you know, there's Donatello and Verrocchio so he came out of this tradition where, this would have been sort of second nature, and I doubt all of these sort of great sculptors fell on that spectrum. But again, as I said, I don't know. If you read about his personality, I'm not sure that it fits that well. I think he was, certainly his difficulties had to do with arrogance, misanthropy, and sort of a touchiness and pride. But it's an interesting thesis, and I'd be interested if somebody pursues it.
Thanks, Barb. Saul says this on email. To me, the slave sculptures, especially the bearded slave, are his most amazing works, where we get to see the figures emerging from the stone.
Yeah, those are wonderful works. Most of those are in the Accademia in Florence, the same building that houses the David. So you walk through these, you know, sort of amazing half-finished works, and when you see the David in the distance, it's an amazing, awe-inspiring experience. I think to many sort of contemporary viewers, the unfinished works are almost more powerful, more poignant than the finished ones, because the finished ones are so, have an almost superhuman skill and polish and finish to them, whereas the half-finished works, you can really see the artist sort of probing the stone and, you know, as he said famously, releasing the figure from the stone. I mean, he really did have a sense that that the figure was in there, and that the job of the sculptor was to sort of probe until he found it, so that carving was an art of discovery. And this works particularly well with the captives, who are themselves shown struggling as if they're trying to free themselves from the matrix of the stone, becoming the forms they were always meant to be. So I guess those are very powerful, and I think some of the most moving and powerful works he ever created.
Mm. Linda in Oshkosh.
Hi. I was in Rome, actually, the weekend that there was the canonization, and did have a chance to see Michelangelo's works, which were stunning. And I wonder if you had any comment about the creation and the little blurb about the two fingers coming together and the image of a slice of brain, as if God is giving Adam the brain of God, if you will.
I've heard the brain. I don't know about the two fingers. The brain, what you're referring to is the image of God with a host of angels surrounded by this robe, and it does look remarkably like a sort of cross section of the human brain, and which has some plausibility because Michelangelo was known to have spent a lot of time dissecting cadavers, so it may have been a form he was familiar with, but I'm again a little skeptical of sort of that kind of reading. I did an article once about artists who find inspiration in sort of water stains on rocks or a gnarled tree. I mean, I think the human brain has an enormous capacity to see similarities, to see images, particularly faces, in forms, and maybe at some subconscious level. Not to make a pun, maybe it was in the back of his mind. But I, as I said, I'm a little skeptical of a kind of, you know, simplistic reading that is the meaning of this. I think, you know, biological forms are sort of tend to repeat themselves, and maybe at some subconscious level there's some resonance there. But I think, you know, if you want to just put that in there, in the mix, I'm fine with that. But if one says, okay, this is what he meant by this, I would think that's going a little too far.
Linda, thanks. We have about 30 seconds. Joel from Ashland, can you get your comment in?
I will try. Thank you.
Okay.
Earlier on, your guest was speaking of the force of personality and the status of the artist that Michelangelo thought. It was reminiscent of Beethoven to me. I don't know if that's a good analogy, or if you consider, you know, taking on a half a dozen artists of various sorts that have had the force of their personality elevate the art or its position in the world.
Interesting.
Yeah, no, I actually think it's a wonderful analogy, and one that I've thought of many times. The Beethoven, you know, comparing, let's say, Beethoven to Mozart versus Michelangelo and Raphael. They're all wonderful artists, and Mozart is a wonderful composer, but Mozart could sort of do anything. He could play any role, and his operas, are so wonderful because he can put himself in the head of any character. But I think one would be hard-pressed to sort of say, you know, what is Mozart's personality coming through the music? Whereas I think you're very right that Beethoven, you feel, you know, if you listen to the Ninth or the late quartets or the Fifth Symphony, or some of the great concertos, mm-hmm. you feel that kind of, you know, that sense of the artist's personality coming through.
And on that note, thank you. Thank you, Miles. Thanks for writing the book. It was great. It'll be with us always. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, our pleasure. Miles Unger, the book is Michelangelo, A Life in Six Masterpieces. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this wonderful show, and to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Great conversations ahead. We'll return tomorrow at 1 o'clock.